Thanks, Lily. I love that song. It just impacts me every time I sing it because it's so true. I mean, these words that we're reading that today were written 2,000 years ago, that's ancient. And yet they've been imbued with a life and a vitality and a force and a power by the Spirit of God that brings them alive in our lives as we live them out. It's amazing how these words written so long ago have so much instruction and guidance and power for us today. Today we're looking at the topic of family, and maybe some of you remember the old song, We Are Family. I'm not going to sing it for you or play it for you right now, but family is important. You know, family, we're talking about road signs, a series on road signs, and we're kind of taking the idea that throughout Scripture, you know, these ancient words, God has posted road signs for us to help us along the way for whatever road we're traveling down. And we travel down the road of faith. We talked about that last week. Today we're talking about the road of family life. It's a road that everybody has to travel down, the road of family life. Family is the first and most important social structure instituted by God. Right back in Genesis chapter 1, God creates the world and then he institutes marriage. And he says to his to that husband and wife, Adam and Eve, he says, now go out and be fruitful and multiply. Have kids. Raise families. God instituted it, and he blessed it. And so it's important. In Genesis 1, we see God's plan for the world and everything that he did. And this plan of a man, he said in Genesis 1 there, it says that a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. I've had people ask me, why does it say that man shall leave his husband and wife, or his the man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to the wife? It almost sounds like the man is the weak creature there who needs, once he gets out of the house, he has to find a wife, you know. That's not what it is. You know, the Bible, these words in Genesis 1 were written to counteract a pagan worldview. And in the pagan worldview, it was a very patriarchal society where the father, the patriarch of the family, he had control over his children. And so, you know, if he had daughters, he could marry them off and get extra cows and sheep with them. If he had sons, they would bring a wife in and they would have children, which could bolster the family enterprise. And so he kept them under his roof and under his control. Genesis 1 says, no, that's not the way it is. It says, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to a wife and start a totally new and indestructible and autonomous unit. And so that was totally, it doesn't mean you forget about your father. It doesn't mean you leave him to fend for himself. You might help him out every now and then, same way he helped you out many thousands of times through your life. But it's just the model that God created there right at the very beginning. Of course, Satan is the destroyer. He's out to disrupt God's plan in any way that he possibly can. And the sad fact of the matter is that today, on this primary and vital institution of marriage and the family life that develops around that, Satan is destroying that today in every way he possibly can. And he does it through all kinds of means. He might do it through pornography. He might do it through affairs that men have, or women have. He might do it through all kinds of conflict. He might do it through logic and reason. He can do it through all kinds of different ways. But he's out to destroy marriage because he knows that that's God's plan for the world. The fact is that many families today are hit with strife and with fracture and with dysfunction within their family. Why is it so hard? Well, it's because of a little thing called human nature. That's why we have to work so hard at working at keeping our families together and keeping them vibrant and keeping them healthy. I heard a story of a father who was pouring a cement sidewalk, and as he was working along, he was engrossed in his work. He didn't realize that his kids were at the other end, and they had some sticks, and they were writing their names in the cement. And when he saw that, he got angry with them, and he yelled at them, and you could hear him all around the neighborhood. And the wife finally came out and said, honey, keep it down. You know, you're supposed to love your kids. And he says, well, I love them in the abstract, just not in the concrete. But you know, it's true that it's easy to love people in the abstract, but sometimes it's hard to love them in the concrete. And family life is where the concrete happens. That's where, you know, personalities rub up against each other all the time, and that's where differences of opinion are always coming to the fore. And that's the concrete facts of life. And But family life, nonetheless, is a road that everyone will travel down, and we want to see what are the road signs that God has given to us to keep us on that road. And in Colossians chapter 3, this passage that Pastor John read for us, verses 12 to 21, it ends off talking about family life. But I think that Paul here in the first few verses, he's taking general rules of behavior that we should be learning and applying in all aspects of our life. But I think it sets up a beautiful context for us to think about family life. And so we're going to look at these principles in Colossians 3 as to how they apply to family life. And just under this heading, that family is a place for different things. And first off, I think what we see here is that family life is a place for nurturing. It's a place where babies and children are nurtured and developed and grown up into the people that they are going to be. You know, when I think of nurturing, I think of, you know, when you plant a small shrub in your garden, and that little shrub has the potential to grow into a mighty tree. But when it's small, it needs careful nurture, and so it's probably started out in a greenhouse somewhere where it's protected from the elements and the cold weather. And then when you put it in your garden, you give mulch and fertilizer around the roots so that it'll establish good, strong roots. And you're careful when you trim it, you know, you want to trim that thing so it grows just right. You're not going to take a chainsaw to a little sapling. You know, you're going to come out with the secateurs and carefully nip off the branches. That kind of nurturing and care is what we're thinking about here, and family life provides a safe place for the nurture of human beings that have the potential to grow up into great individuals and have impact in this world. And Paul here is setting a standard of behavior for God's holy people. And you see, here's the point. As you read through the Bible and you take these things and you understand, he's not setting a standard for the world to follow. He's setting a standard for those who are committed to the cause of Christ. And he starts off by saying, therefore, where's the verse here? Verse 12. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, here's how you ought to live. Here's how you ought to behave. Clothe yourselves with compassion. I mean, these are all nurturing words. Compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience. They're words of nurture. And compassion is the ability to be able to empathize with another individual. Kindness is, well, that's the opposite of harshness and anger. The Bible talks a lot about speaking words and kindness. Humility, that's thinking of yourself less. It's not thinking less of yourself, okay? Get that straight. You know, a lot of times we think that humility means, oh, I got to put myself down all the time. That's not what it means. It's not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less than others. Gentleness is that soft touch. The Bible says that gentle words turn aside anger. Patience is certainly a much-needed quality when we're dealing with family members, isn't it? Disastrous consequences can result when a child or a young person sees his parents put on this holy act on Sunday, and maybe when we come out to church where everybody's watching us, but then at home, there's no compassion there, there's no kindness, there's no humility or patience. That speaks of hypocrisy. That speaks of phoniness. And that turns off the children who grow up in a household like that. We are called as God's holy people to portray these kinds of characteristics in all of life, but especially in our family life, where human lives can be nurtured. Second thing that we see here is that family life is a place of restoration. You know, you have human relationships, people being living together in close quarters, it's going to lead to inevitable conflict. There are going to be differences of opinion. There are going to be mistakes made. There are going to be impatient words spoken at various times. There are going to be feelings hurt. But that conflict, if it's left unresolved, can be very damaging to a person's confidence and self-esteem. And so when you have that conflict with that other individual, you are called upon to resolve it. to get over it, to do something to take care of it. And in Colossians 3:13, we hear this. Paul says this, bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. When he says bear with each other, that just means literally putting up with each other. You know, family is great because family is the one place that I can go and they got to take me in, you know, however I may be. Now, this doesn't mean that you don't correct bad behavior. I mean, obviously, discipline is an important part of raising children as well. And sometimes, you know what? I need correction from my wife. There are times my wife corrects me. I found that it seems to be easier for wives to correct husbands than for husbands to correct wives. You know, if she gives a word of correction to me, I'm like, okay, fine, you know, I'll take. If I give a word of correction to her, like, you know, it's like, come on. Yeah. She's not here this morning. But words of correction are important. They need to be spoken and they need to be heard. But, you know, we bear with each other. That's patience in practice. We just talked about patience earlier. And forgive. You know, forgiveness, how do you correct a wrong? Well, sometimes there's restitution to be made, you know, and sometimes you have to do something new. But the way that you restore that relationship, if something wrong has happened, is you forgive. You ask for forgiveness, and then you give forgiveness in return. And when you're able to do that, those uncomfortable situations and mistakes of the past can be corrected. And fathers, I'm going to bring this theme up a few times through here. As the leader in your home, you need to set the example in forgiveness, being willing to ask for forgiveness and being willing to give forgiveness. You know, when I think about this, I just think of one situation when we were living in Mississauga and Shelley was out that evening and I was home with the four kids and I was trying to get them into bed and they were high strung that night and finally I lost it. You guys get upstairs right now. And I was rounding them upstairs and four bodies were scampering up the stairs and all into their beds and pulled up the, you know, and I was angry. And I went down to the living room and tried to read a book. That doesn't work. I'm sitting there. I can't concentrate anymore. And then I thought, you know what? Maybe, you know, they were trying me. They were testing my patience. But I didn't have to act that way. And I went upstairs and stood in the hallway. And I said, hey, kids, I want to say something. And these four heads appear in the doorways, you know. And I said, look, I'm sorry for what I said. I was upset with you, and you should have obeyed me earlier, but I'm sorry for the way that I did this. I just want you to know that. And one of them said, that's okay, Dad. We deserved it. The others kind of picked up on that theme. Yeah, we should have been more obedient. I said, okay, get to bed, and let's start out new in the morning. You know, I think back to that. That's just a precious moment of restoration and reconciliation. It was a small thing. We would have got over it, but I'm glad I said that. You know, set the example, men, in your family for what it means to forgive and also to even ask for forgiveness. Well, a third thing that we need in family life is security. This is so important. You know, when we're talking about road signs, if you're driving down the highway on a rainy night or a snowy day, and you know how that can be exhausting, you look forward to seeing this sign, don't you? There's a rest area up ahead. I can just pull off, and I can relax my fingers off the steering wheel, and I can maybe have a little drink, stretch my legs, and then hit the road again. Family life should be a rest area. It's so important that it provides security from the world around us. And, you know, the world can be a very unsettling place. As babies, you know, learning how to walk, and they fall down, and they stumble, and they bang themselves, and they cry, and the world is so hard, the baby fell down and is crying now, and what happens? Mother swoops over and picks her up and soothes her and gives her a kiss all better, and she's got that sense of security there. That need for security never ends. We need that in order to make us feel able to go out and try it again. And Paul talks about the, family is a place for security. And Paul talks about this in Colossians 3:15, where that was my error because I corrected these slides later. But Colossians 3:15, Paul talks about peace. You know, you can't have security without peace. And he says, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, and by extension, in your homes as well. Since as members of one body, you were called to peace, and be thankful. Be thankful. Peace is so important. Peace is something that, you know, we sometimes we just need to get away from things, don't we? And find that place of peace and security. I heard about a men's retreat way off in the mountains somewhere, and in the evening they were sitting around the fire, and they were kind of going around the circle sharing why they came to this retreat. And one man, well, you know, the pressures of work were just getting so overwhelming, I just had to get out and get reoriented. And the next guy, he said, well, you know, I live down in the middle of the city, and there's noise, and there's pollution, and there's people and cars all over the place, and I just needed to come away to find restoration for my soul. And third guy says, well, I'm here because my son's learning how to play saxophone. But the place of peace, right? Place where he could come and just get away from it all. Home and family life should be a place of peace. It's where I can come home after a hard day or a bad experience and find healing and restoration. You know, even as an adult, we need that. When I failed at something, how do you feel when you failed at something, when you made a mistake? You feel vulnerable. You feel exposed, don't you? You just want to get somewhere where you feel comfortable. And home should be that kind of a place. We can go and just feel safe and where it provides the peace and security to, for someone to be able to say to you, you know, don't worry about it. It's not the end of the world. You can go out and do it again. You can try it again. You can get back on your feet. That's what home should provide, especially for those children that we are developing and growing up as little human beings. A godly family is a place of peace and security. The next thing is that a godly family is a place that provides for spiritual development. You know, there are many, many different ways you can travel your roads today, aren't there? They go all over the place, and sometimes it can get pretty confusing. You ever run across a sign like that? I mean, I can't even make out what that sign, notice it says good luck underneath it. I don't know if that's a legit road sign or what, but how in the world do you make it through all this? The closest thing I came to seeing a sign like that was when I was driving in England. And, of course, you're on the left-hand side of the road to begin with, and that's disorienting. And then they have all these dastardly traffic circles. And you hit one, and I see we're starting to pick them up here in this country now, too. But you go, and here's this sign. It's got traffic circle, and then arrows going off, and then another traffic circle, and arrows going off, and then another traffic circle. And, man, it can get so confusing. And certainly in our homes, we need to be providing spiritual development. We need to be providing a sure way and a sure path for our children to know how to walk into the future. I heard a story about a family that was, they had a little boy, 5 years old, and of course his name is Little Johnny, right? Every little boy is named Johnny. And then they were dedicating their little baby, their newborn baby. And afterwards, Little Johnny was all upset and he was, you know, obviously upset and crying a little bit. And his parents said, well, what's the matter, Johnny? He said, well, I'm worried. The pastor said that he wants us kids to grow up in a Christian home. But I want to stay with you guys. I would say that those parents have some work to do. If little Johnny couldn't make that out. Well, you know, in Colossians 3:16, Paul says this, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom. Let the word of Christ be the thing that fills your knowledge and your mind and your heart and everything about you this is what you use to teach and admonish one another with all wisdom and as you sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs with gratitude in your hearts to God. He talks here about the word of Christ dwelling richly in us. I think what he means there is that we should be so full of God's word that when you speak, that's what comes out. that kind of knowledge and that kind of instruction and that kind of wisdom is what you is how you speak when you got the word of Christ dwelling in you richly like this. And it's as if Christ is speaking through you. And we're to teach and admonish. Now, teaching, these are two different concepts. Teaching, of course, is something that we impart information. And this teaching that we give is based on the word of Christ. It's so important to teach our children. Teach our children the word of Christ. Have those devotional times with them, whether it's around the table or at their bedsides before they go to bed at night, to be able to present to them the principles of God's word and talk to them about those things. And these things must be taught over and over and over again. You know what strikes me about, we're watching a lot of hockey these days with the playoffs happening, and you know, it strikes me that these are professional hockey players. These are guys that have been instructed in hockey from the time that they've been 8, 9, 10 years old, some of them. And yet when they come back to the bench after a play and they sit down, what happens? The coach right away walks over to him and he points out things to him. He says, go this way, go this way, and you got to come around here. And you can see the coaches talking to these guys as they're sitting on the bench. After 20 years of playing hockey, these guys are still receiving instruction. We continually need instruction as children and even as adults as well. Don't ever say that you think you've heard it all or that you know enough. Teaching must happen over and over again, and we base it on the word of Christ. Admonish is a little stronger word. It carries with it the sense of correcting someone. So you teach your child to tell the truth, but then you admonish him if he's being tempted to lie or if you catch him in a lie, right? That's where the admonishing comes in. It's a little bit stronger term. But certainly home is the first line of spiritual development in your children's lives. Don't think that the church is going to do it all. Don't think that sending him to youth is going to take care of all the spiritual development. The spiritual development must take place first and foremost in your homes. It's your responsibility to make sure that that happens. Another thing that we see here about family living is that family is a place for orderly living. Now, when we start talking about order in the house, and we start talking about roles of mothers and fathers and children and so on, this is where we might see a warning sign like this. Be careful. This has the potential of getting slippery really fast and maybe sending you off the road. But nonetheless, Paul, over and over again, when we read Paul's words, we find him stressing things like living peaceful lives and ordered lives and lives that are disciplined and all these things. And remember, he was writing to these Christians who were living in this pagan society filled with all kinds of immoral excesses and all kinds of dysfunction and all kinds of pagan practices. And he's saying, look, that's how the world lives, but you are to live this way. And so Paul laid out these house rules. House rules were common in the first century, but Paul has a Christianized version of these house rules. And we need to recognize that these are Christian in nature. Paul is telling them how to live and how to conduct their family affairs in the midst of a pagan society. Now, some people might say, well, I don't really agree with all this submission and headship stuff. Well, then in that case, you are choosing an order of living that is different than what the Bible clearly teaches. Now, if you want to live that way, okay, I guess, you know, I certainly can't be responsible for that. Paul lays out some very clear house rules here. In these three verses of Colossians 3, 18, 19, and 20, he says, wives, submit to your husbands, as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives, and do not be harsh with them. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. And in just a few lines, Paul has laid out an orderly existence for family life that Christian homes should give evidence to. Now, the submission headship topic is a big topic. There are lots of books that are written about it. We could go, there are conferences that are held on this topic that you can go to. You can find just about anything you want about it on the internet. But simply put, I like to boil it down to its simplest terms, and I see it this way, that a wife is willing to submit to and support a husband that she respects. One who is loving and caring and able to make wise and confident decisions for the family. There are so many times that I have heard women say to me, I just wish he would step up and take responsibility. I wish he would just step up and say something in the midst of these situations, that he would just give direction to our family. I wish he would do that, talking about her husband, obviously. I just wish he would do that. Because then the kids would obey, then the kids would listen, then we would know what we're doing. And as I see it and as I hear it, women are looking for that in their husbands. They're looking for that kind of confidence. And it doesn't mean you're going to be right all the time. It doesn't mean that you don't listen to somebody else's opinion. And it doesn't mean that you don't sit down and say, honey, what do you think? I want to talk this over with you before I make a decision, because I want to know that it's going to be okay for both of us. I think that's a wise thing to do. But ultimately, to be able to say, yes, this is what we're going to do. You know, women want a confident, loving husband. Guys, those of you that aren't married yet, here's some dating advice for you. Don't be a wuss. Okay? Don't be pushy, but be confident. You know, I mean, can you imagine a scenario where a guy comes up and says, you want to go out with me? And she says, well, he looks like kind of a nice guy. Yeah, sure. What are we going to do? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I haven't really thought about that yet, you know. Oh, well, what night did you have in mind? Oh, I don't know. what night do you want? Which would you like? You know, after a while, she's going to be thinking, does this guy even know what he wants? Like, and interestingly enough, teenage girls are drawn to confident guys. That's psychology. They're drawn to that kind of a person. The family order, that be confident. That's all I'm saying, guys. Be confident. Family order, Paul lays out, is that the husband is to give loving leadership. And he spells that out in Ephesians 5, how Christ loved the church. The wife is to give respectful support to her husband in those things. And children are to obey. Children are to obey. That's how order is maintained in the home. And again, the parents might ask what the child wants to do. They might ask, well, you know. But ultimately, it's the parents' call. Anyway, we could say a lot more about that. We need to move on. Lastly, family is a place for encouragement. You know, Paul's last words here to fathers are regarding encouragement. We all know that children brighten our lives, usually by leaving the lights on all over the place. But they brighten our lives. We need to brighten their lives as well. How do you brighten your kid's life? With words of encouragement. How do you put out the lights in your kid's life? By what this verse says, embittering your children. By harping on them about the same thing over and over and over and over again. By never extending to them a word of encouragement or kindness. That's how you put out their light. Paul says, fathers, and notice he's speaking to fathers here, do not embitter your children or they will become discouraged. Boy, you know, I read that and I think, Paul, he could have been a psychologist. You know, he lived in an age where the patriarch was the ruler of the house and ruled with an iron fist and demanded certain things of his children, and the patriarch had ultimate authority over everything that happened in his kids' lives. And Paul's saying, no, you know what? As a Christian, you need to temper that a little bit. Yes, you need to be in authority. Yes, you need to be responsible. Yes, you need to give direction, but don't embitter your children or they will become discouraged. Remember, we're building up, we're nurturing and developing these little saplings to grow into big trees. Don't destroy them before they get started. It's said that it takes 10 positive statements to overcome one negative statement. And yet how quickly those negative statements can escape from our lips without even thinking. The book of Proverbs says that there's the power of life and death is in the tongue. You can give life to somebody by what you speak to them, or you can speak words of death to them, emotional and psychological death, mental death, as it were. Continual criticism will kill a child's self-esteem. It will destroy your relationship with them. And you know what else? It might just drive them away from you into a friendship with somebody else that you don't approve of. Because they're going to look for that kind of acceptance. They're going to look for encouragement somewhere. And if they don't find it from you, they'll find it somewhere else. You know, all of this stuff about family living, there's a lot of hard work here, isn't there? And you know, sometimes we just don't have the wisdom and the knowledge and the ability in every single situation to do what's right. And while a lot of this speaks to situations of the home life where we're raising up young children, yet even now today I find these things applicable principles in my life. When I'm talking to my children that are all grown up and moved out of the house now, and I can see the difference between, for example, words of encouragement and words of criticism. You got to be careful how you use those, even now today, and maintaining whatever, you know, maintaining the relationships that we have and nurturing those. It's so important. But so many times, you know, we think, well, I see what's happening, and sometimes I just feel like I'm just not up to the task. It's so difficult for me to do all the things that are necessary that I'm called upon to do in this family life setting. And as parents, sometimes we feel like no matter what we do and no matter how hard we try, it doesn't work out. You know, we feel like a little kid sitting at the piano. You know, here's this keyboard with all 88 keys and all the potential that there is in there and all the thousands of tunes that can be played on this wonderful piano keyboard, and all we can plunk out is chopsticks. You know? You ever, you know that one? You know what I'm talking about? Dun 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 dun. You know, any 6-year-old kid knows how to play that. And it seems like we don't get beyond that, and it's so frustrating. You know, there's a story about the pianist, Jan Paderewski. It's kind of a legendary story about him. Nobody can actually prove that it happened. But I love it because Jan Paderewski was a world-renowned pianist. He lived from about 1870 to 1940, kind of in that range. At one time, he was a prime minister of Poland. But he was a concert pianist, and he was in somewhere in New York giving a concert, and before the concert happened, before he came out, all the people were gathered there, getting ready, and a little boy was there with his mother up in the front row, up in the second row, and she got distracted, and she was talking to her friends, and he was a fidgety little guy, and he got out of the row, and he comes up on the stage, and he sat down at the piano. He sat down there, and he started plunking out chopsticks. And all of a sudden, everybody in the auditorium was, what's that kid doing up there? He shouldn't be up there. And Paderewski was just off stage, and he quickly assessed what was happening. And he came out behind the boy, and he says to him, keep playing, keep playing. And he started to play on either side of what this little boy was plunking out chopsticks. He starts playing with the treble and the bass, and he made this little dinky little song turned into this masterpiece, and when they were all done, everybody applauded, and the little boy went down and sat with his mother again. And you know, I think about the job that parents especially have in regards to family life. And it just seems like sometimes you try things and they don't work. You know, you want to do something special for the weekend, so you put a tent in the car and you go off to a provincial park, and it rains all weekend and the mosquitoes are bad and you burn the food over the fire, and then you come back and you find out that your kid's friends, they, you know, their parents took them to Disneyland for the week, and you know, they went three days in the park and 4 days on the beach learning how to surf, but you know, surf dude, you know. And you think, oh man. And then, you know, so you buy some games for your kids to play at home, but the kid's friend, you know, his dad bought him the latest PlayStation, you know, on his 55-inch TV, and he's always over there, and you're thinking, do I let him go? Do I try to keep him here? If I try to keep him here, he might resent me. If I let him go, he might be, you know, getting into influences that, you know, it's so tough to make these decisions. And, you know, you look at the other family, and their kids are all in advanced placement courses, and they're acing their trigonometry and calculus and chemistry, and they're on track to be doctors and lawyers and everything else. And you're sitting there at the kitchen table with the kid's math book, and you're trying to figure out with him, wow, what this is. And you're thinking, man, who thinks this stuff up? You know, this new math. And, you know, it just seems like some demonically inspired system of numbers and equations. And you just, if you could just get a C, if you could just get through with a C, and you're just so weighed down by it all. You feel like while other people are playing Tchaikovsky concertos, you're sitting there plunking out chopsticks. And that's when Jesus comes up behind you and says, keep going. Don't stop. And he plays, he fills in all the rest. He says, just trust me. Keep looking to me. Keep doing your best. Keep following my word. Trust in me, and we'll make this thing work. We're singing a hymn in closing. Come on up, Lily. That, I think, speaks to that truth. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Soul, are you weary and troubled? No light in the darkness, you see. There's light for a look at the Savior and life more abundant and free. And we know, we can know, that whatever life throws at us, however difficult things may be and in our situation, that we've got someone to come to whose name is Jesus. You know, if there's anything that you would like to receive prayer for this morning, we've got people up here that are church leaders who will pray for you. If there's anything that God is speaking to you about today and you're saying, you know what, I need help in this area or that area, or I just need to learn to trust the Lord more, come on up while we sing. We'd be more than happy to pray for you and listen to you and send you on your way. Let's stand together. Lily, lead us as we sing.